The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
One thing that I wanted to do with this book is complicate how people might think about those solidified identity categories like blackness, like Muslimness, like immigrantness.
El Amin Abdel Mahmoud talks about his new memoir, Son of Elsewhere, about growing up in Canada after moving there from Sudan when he was 12.
Why were these women and children traveling alone on one of the most dangerous roads in the world? Where were the men?
The investigative journalist and author Sally Denton discusses The Colony, which explores a Mormon sect in Mexico. Plus, Alexandra Alter has news from the publishing world, and The Times' critics Alexandra Jacobs and Jennifer Salai talk about books they've recently reviewed. This is the Book Review Podcast. It's July 15th. I'm John Williams. El Amin Abdel Mahmoud is here. He is a senior culture writer for BuzzFeed, and his first book, which he's here to talk about, is Son of Elsewhere, a memoir in pieces. In the New York Times, our critic Jennifer Salai writes that the book is funny and frank, delivered in such a generous spirit that almost any reader is bound to be won over by Abdel Mahmoud's story of trying to figure out who he was. El Amin joins us from Toronto. Thanks for being here.
Hey, John. How's it going?
It's going well. I want to start by just saying in broad strokes that this is a memoir about your time during and after moving from Sudan to Canada when you were 12 years old. I have a very, very palely Xeroxed version of that story, which is that I moved from Long Island, New York to a suburb of Dallas, Texas when I was 14. And I got a lot of comments from my Long Island friends before I moved about how I would be riding a cow to school and, you know, all these things that they really didn't understand about where I was headed.
Right.
Take me back to when you were 12, what your childhood was like in Sudan, and then what it was like to learn that you were going to be moving.
Okay, first of all, that's not a Xerox version at all. I think there's something about the idea of moving from one place to the other where you begin to take on other people's ideas of the place that you're moving to. I grew up in Sudan, and I was 12 when I first moved to Canada. My years previous to that, my dad left Sudan when I was 7 years old, and his plan was to go find us a better life somewhere else. And he first went to Switzerland, and then he came to Canada. And honestly, I had no idea what Canada would be like when I was living in Sudan, because there's so much talk about America. There's so much talk about green cards. There's so much talk about the immigration lottery that you try to get. But Canada, the impression was, listen, it's like a land of ice and snow, and it's sort of like attached to America somewhat. And moving to this place, I had no idea what to expect. And you know what? Honestly, I was quite pleased. I'm a big fan of this place.
And when you got there, you were moving to Kingston. Tell us a little bit about that place and what your first impressions of it were.
So here's a story. I land in Canada July of the year 2000. I land here and I'm cold. It's the middle of the summer, but I've arrived here and I'm freezing cold on this July night. And my dad goes, oh boy, here we go. This is going to be a bit of a difficult transition for you. The thing about Kingston is that it's a couple hours east of Toronto. It's a predominantly white town. It is not a town that you would say most immigrants, when they come to settle in Canada, move to. Most immigrants settle in one of the larger towns, whether it's a Toronto or a Montreal or a Vancouver. But my dad chose Kingston. And so my impression of Kingston was, okay, first of all, oh my God, there's a bunch of people who don't look like me. This is the first time I'm encountering that. But then I get some family members who say, hey, by the way, you're in Canada now, and that means you're black in this context. And this is news to me because I'd lived up until that point a dozen years and I'd never been black that whole time because my skin color didn't have any particular context to it. And then I came to this place and suddenly there is a history of blackness that I got to get caught up on. And the only place that I could see that blackness represented, other people who look like me represented because I'm in Kingston, is the TV. And so there's like this Ja Rule. That's what I have to look to and say, that's black? I don't know. I don't know if I want to be a part of this.
There are a lot of cultural references in the book, and it is very funny, as our critic noted, but obviously that's also a very tough transition in many ways, even if you're pleased with the place and you have your family there as sort of a safety. What was the attitude of the other kids there? Were they curious about what your life had been like? Were they judgmental? Did they embrace you? Did they freeze you out? I imagine it was maybe a little bit of all of it.
Well, the first obstacle was just language. I couldn't even figure out what they were saying about me because I didn't really speak English when I came to this country. And so there was this dimension of it, of okay, we've landed this new place. I got to figure out how people communicate here just to figure out how to communicate to them. And so I didn't get an impression aside from there's a bit of curiosity there and there's a bit of, we don't really know a lot of people who speak like you. For example, the accent that I had when I first moved here and it was like learning how to speak English, it meant that certain letters or certain words I would pronounce in a way and they would not understand me. And like some people were kind enough to take the time to say, what is this kid trying to say? And then others who were like, okay, I don't need to bother with any of this. It took me a bit of time to figure out some pop culture doors to relate to other people. Some of them were like things like wrestling, for example. Some of them were things like just like listening to music, because music became one of the connective tissues that I had between me and other kids as I began to say, okay, if I'm going to exist in this space and I'm going to be enmeshed with these people, let us try to understand each other.
It sounds like you're painting a picture of something that overall, while it had its challenges, there was a sense of maybe patience on the part of other people, or, you know, this was a place that maybe was so predominantly white that they didn't feel threatened or there wasn't a lot of bigotry, or was there any of that as part of the mix?
No, this is not a story of bigotry. This is not a story of a classic playground bully. Most of the demons I was wrestling with in this book were actually returning to the feelings of me needing to put certain parts of my identity on the shelf. Because sometimes you don't really have to wait for other people to reduce you. You can do that to yourself. So I came to Canada and as I was trying to fit in, for me, one of the things that sort of became obvious very quickly is I don't want to stand out. I don't want the attention of being the new kid, the immigrant kid. I don't want to be different. I don't want to trigger any alarm bells in the heads of anybody else around here that I'm from somewhere else. And so I think very early on, I kind of learned to put a few of my identities on the shelf. I learned to put my blackness on the shelf and say, I'm not associated with whatever you call blackness. Same thing with Muslimness. I didn't want to be associated with being Muslim. I didn't want to be associated with being an immigrant. I did that. I did the labor of sort of erasing those parts of my identity in order to not be a nuisance. And by that, I mean not be a reason for anyone else to be inconvenienced in any kind of way, because that would mean then I could disappear for a little bit.
Right, to not stand out when you're first trying to adapt to a new place. And so eventually, obviously, cultural doors, as you put it, you started to learn which ones to open to make some friends and to establish some social life. From an early stage, how did encountering the kind of pop culture there and adapting to it, how did that feel compared to your life up to 12 years old? And did it feel somehow instinctively easy to you, maybe even easier than language? How did those compare to each other?
Well, the first few pop culture doors that I opened, the first one was wrestling. And by this, I mean like the world wrestling entertainment stuff. And that's because wrestling doesn't really ask a lot of you. You know, like wrestling is, if you're just watching wrestling on TV, you know who the good guy is by the boos and the cheers. Like you don't need to understand the plot line. There's not a lot of plot line. There's mostly just people hitting each other. And for me, that became something that's easy to understand, something that's easy to sort of relate to. And I didn't know this at the time, because at the time I thought the kids who watch wrestling, well, those were the cool ones. Turns out this is not quite true, okay? But that knowledge came later. But the start of my love of wrestling introduced me to the first couple of people who would ever come to my house as sort of the white kids from the school who would come to my house and watch wrestling with me. And later on, I would end up being enmeshed in this universe where I would write wrestling fan fiction. And we are talking thousands of words a week.
When's the collection of that coming out? Is that your follow-up?
That's never has been buried as we speak. In
How
a place
old were you when you were writing? It in the mountain where we keep nuclear waste. It's out in Nevada somewhere.
That's exactly where it's going to stay. I think I probably started that when I was like maybe 13, 14, and I kept doing it until I was maybe 18 or so. And I got quite good at it. I mean, like, this is a sort of an internet universe where you and other people compete against each other, pretending to be different pre-existing wrestling characters. And then you would say you would write a role play as, I don't know, The Undertaker. And you would maybe write a scene where he is. And you'd get a certain number of thousands of words every week to compete against another person. And then these impartial judges would essentially just judge your fan fiction against other fan fiction. That's all this was. But here's the thing, John. You can get so good at this that you eventually develop your own character, right? Like you just give them their own name. I had this guy, Taylor Stanton, and me and Taylor Stanton, let me tell you, we won championships by the time that our run was coming to an end.
You know, you must be a really good writer because I have to say that Taylor Stanton sounds like the 140-pound guy that they feed to the headliner in the first match who wears the old style Greco-Roman wrestling tights. I went through a big wrestling phase myself around the same age. It was, you know, WWF and NWA, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, that era. And it was, to me, I always say that I never really read Tolkien or Dune. It was kind of my fantasy world. And so it makes a lot of sense to me that it's a place where you felt comfortable kind of escaping to and communing with people around it. And as you got older, it almost sounds like the move also gave you, the move from Sudan to Canada, created maybe the impetus to write and work out some of your thoughts that way. Is that how you feel you got involved in what eventually became your career?
I think so. I think it sort of like begins to give you the building blocks of, you know, you can write your way out of things. You can write your way through things. And that's a really valuable lesson for someone to learn in that age. I don't know if I ever actually intended for this specifically to be my career, but it kind of felt natural to me because I've had this kind of long teen experience of doing this. And, you know, when we talk about pop culture, like some of the other pop culture doors that I walked through were things like, do you remember the show The O.C.? The 2003 yes. show. Yeah. So like, here's the thing, like The OC is not remembered particularly like favorably, if remembered like at all. I think this is something of a moment that was like a flash in the pan. It happened, then it was gone. But The OC perfectly dovetailed with the time when I was learning to speak English, but also think in English. And I was a serial and professional crusher. Like I had a lot of crushes at the time. And one thing that The OC gave me is like the permission to just be as melodramatic about crushes as possible. And I got a chance to sort of revisit that period of time. Pop culture was a key way for me to relate to other people.
Away from the cultural stuff and back to family, I'm curious why your dad chose Kingston, because you said most people didn't, and also what your relationship with them was like, how it shifted when you moved to Canada, and how the ensuing years were in terms of how they tried to get you adapted to this new life and the tensions there.
The story about how my dad came to choose Kingston was that he actually settled in Toronto. He got an apartment in Toronto, like many other immigrants who come to this country do. There's a pretty large, significant Sudanese Canadian community in Toronto. And after staying here for a little while, he went to visit a friend in Kingston. And the day that he returned back to his apartment in Toronto, there was a shooting not too far from his apartment. And he felt like he couldn't bring his family to a place that felt that unsafe. And so he kind of picked up his bags and he went to Kingston, which is like a town of about 150,000 people or so. That was the reasoning behind how he ended up in Kingston, because my dad came to Canada in 1997, and then we joined him 3 years later. So there's a period of time when he's not in Sudan, but we are still in Sudan.
And when you get here, what is their, meaning both your parents, what is their orientation towards this new life? Is it, let's figure out how to be Canadian, let's hold on to our traditions from Sudan, and how much did you feel in sync with their desires around all of that?
I kind of felt like for them, they wanted to introduce me to the wonders of Canada. You know, one of the first road trips I remember taking after arriving in this country is like my dad was like, we're going to hit the road early. We're going to go see Niagara Falls. Like he was really excited to act as a tour guide for us in Canada. But at the same time, there was this other counter tension of, okay, we really got to hold on to our culture. We really got to hold on to some sort of ineffable idea of Sudanese-ness. And that includes religion, but that also includes like the way that we communicate, the way that we observe holidays, that kind of stuff. I think both my parents felt a little bit, let's say, if not worried, then a little bit wary of the invasion, if you will, of Canadianness into our home. And so they felt like they could control it where they could. And that meant, hey, you can go out with your friends, but you got to be home by 7:05. And I'm like, listen, 7:05, the sun hasn't even set. And they say, yeah, we don't care. Like, you got to be back in the house. That felt like a strong tension. And it's mostly because they were so used to religion being the thing that organized our lives in Sudan. And then here in Canada, they really felt an absence thereof. They felt an absence of religion. So we struggled with that. We struggled with that for some time. They sort of relaxed like a little bit after I got some friends who were Christian. And they're like, well, at least they believe in a God. Like, that's fine. And then that changed their orientation to, hey, maybe now you can be home by 8. They still stuck to that idea of strictness. And I sort of understand it now in a different light, in the sense that for them, they were completely worried about changes that they wouldn't know how to deal with. They knew what it's like to be raised in Sudan. They didn't know what it's like to be introduced to all of the Canadianness here. And they thought, you know what? If we can stave off all of these changes for as long as possible, that would be better.
Do you have family in Sudan still? Have you been back?
All of my family, all 1 million cousins are all in Sudan.
Tucked inside this memoir fairly prominently is a love letter of sorts to a highway called the 401 in Canada, which I assume is the main thoroughfare that goes in and out of Toronto or goes through Toronto somewhere. So talk to me about the role that highway played in terms of showing you the country, and also maybe just your sense of what it meant to be in this country and the idea of movement inside of it.
I write in the book that 401 was my first friend in Canada, and I really feel that. When I landed in Pearson International Airport in Toronto, the 401 was a highway that you take out of the airport all the way to Kingston, and it introduced me to what this land is, mostly through a infrastructural sort of organization. Like, oh my God, they have roads and lanes and people follow the rules here. That's pretty wild. That felt new to me. And then the other thing is being witness to this incredibly transformative moment of pulling off the highway slightly so my dad can get a Tim Hortons coffee. And as I watch him in line order the coffee, it dawns on me that my dad now speaks English. Like, there's a whole dimension of him that I had just no idea about. And I sort of had to watch him as he engaged in this other dimension. I was like, whoa, that's my dad. And I'm trying to orient myself toward this man that I hadn't seen in about 5 years or so, and taken all the new pieces of information about him. For example, he now wore glasses. Also, he now has more gray hairs than he did the last time that I saw him. But he speaks English. He speaks a whole language that I don't have much of a grasp of yet. And so it introduced me to this concept of, wow, I have a lot to grasp my mind around. That all happened on that 401 on that very first trip. But then from there on, as the distance between me and my parents grew, the 401 was the highway that sort of witnessed some of the most difficult moments of that. That meant, you know, the drives from Toronto to Kingston, because I moved to Toronto, when I would witness maybe my parents and I have a difficult, intense kind of interaction over them trying to impose some kind of rules around me. And then I would go back on the highway and I'd have to process all of these encounters. That's the place where I went to process these things. There are quite a few hard moments for me happened on the 401, and I'm really grateful for that highway, which I recognize that I'm saying this, but very few people who live around here would be like, yeah, the 401 is a romantic kind of road to be, you know, to be cherished. It's not. I understand that it's not. But for me, I just have a lot of important moments on that highway.
Oh, absolutely. No, I miss Texas highways and the ruminating that one can do on them, good and bad. But obviously, in the culture right now, there's the idea of identity is a big one and gets talked about a lot in a lot of different ways. Your book certainly shows how specific any one individual's experience is. But subtitle is A Memoir in Pieces. And I wonder what you think those pieces add up to, if not to be reductive, but if there's something that it does say about one's identity and the way that you put things on the shelf or don't, the way you talked about earlier. What was the thing you were grasping at overall?
First, let me share with you a little secret just between you and me and the listeners of the New York Times book podcast. I say it's called A Memoir in Pieces because I was deeply intimidated by the prospect of writing a book that begins on page 1 and ends on page 280. That to me is a difficult ask. I still can't quite wrap my mind around that. But you know what? I'm trained in essay. I can do an essay. I can design a precise entry point and exit point. That to me feels a little bit more graspable. I have a bit more experience with that. And so the great secret there is that it's a collection of essays, and I felt great intimidation at the prospect of having it be anything else. That essay that we're talking about, the one about the 401, another secret that we're, let's keep it between us, keep it between friends. That was all written at the same time. It's an essay that sort of organizes the book. It's split up into five parts. It's, you keep returning to it as you keep going through the book, but it was all written at the same time. The decision to split it up came later when it felt like, oh yeah, this is the through line. This highway is the through line of this whole book. With regards to the idea of identity, one thing that I wanted to do with this book is complicate how people might think about those solidified identity categories like blackness, like Muslimness, like immigrantness, by just introducing a slight more complication to say, you don't know how someone feels about their relationship to that category. I certainly would say even 10 years ago that I felt uneasy being in those categories. I felt a distance from them and I didn't want to be anywhere near them. This book is in many ways an attempt at apologizing to those parts of me for putting them in jail for a few years and saying, listen, I don't need you right now. I don't need to talk about my blackness. I don't need to talk about my Muslimness or my immigrantness. And what it does to a person to just put whole parts of themselves on the shelf for that long. And as a result, one of the things that I want to do with this book and say, even if you see someone and they feel comfortable identifying themselves as black, as immigrant, you don't really know the backstory of how they got there. It might be quite a circuitous route and not as straightforward as you might think.
Well, a highway as a through line is certainly appropriate. And the book does ruminate on those questions of identity. There are also some tough moments, a lot of joyful moments. And I think it does bring you back, whatever your experience, to that idea of being of the age when you're starting to figure out the world and your place in it and your relationship to other people. And the book, again, is Son of Elsewhere, a memoir in pieces. Elamine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it.
Hey, my pleasure, man. Let's go watch Ric Flair.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in Southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
The investigative reporter and historian Sally Denton joins me now to talk about her new book, The Colony, Faith and Blood in a Promised Land. In the New York Times Book Review, Julia Shears calls it meticulously researched and says, Denton's book is a testament to what happens when male power under the guise of religious conviction goes unchecked. Sally, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have written many books, and in a couple of them, Mormonism was central to the story. But tell me about the incident that brought you back to the subject for this new book.
The story begins, and it's not completely about the massacre itself, but the story begins on November 4th, 2019, when a caravan of women and children were brutally attacked while traveling, three young mothers and their children while traveling through northern Mexico, leaving nine dead and five other children gravely wounded. There were 14 children between the age of infant and 12 years old. And the victims were members of two Mormon fundamentalist communities in Mexico, one called La Mora in Sonora, the state of Sonora, and the other Colonia La Baron in the state of Chihuahua. These are kind of sister communities that date back many decades, and many of them have dual American-Mexican citizenship. But the families were interrelated through many years of intermarriages. But basically, their forebears, all of them, their forebears broke from the LDS Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and settled in Mexico when polygamy was outlawed. So that's the massacre that happens in 2019, brutal massacre. These women and children were unarmed and unescorted and were shot point blank and by as many as 50, and some say as many as 100 sicarios, drug cartel assassins. And one of the cars was burned and torched, and the young mother and her four children were burned alive.
How much did you know about the LeBaron community at the time that you heard about this incident and decided to research the book?
I didn't know very much at all about the LeBaron community. I knew about the Mormon colonies in northern Mexico. I'd written a book called American Massacre about the Mountain Meadows Massacre in southern Utah in 1857. And many of the perpetrators of that massacre left to go into hiding 20 years later when the U.S. government was demanding that somebody in Utah territory be held accountable for the massacre. And so I knew that some of the perpetrators had left Utah territory and gone into northern Mexico to be outside the reach of the United States justice system. And I had been through there also because I'm descended from a long line of Mormon polygamists. And my parents had a home in Mexico for 30 years. And my father, whose mother was born in polygamy and his grandmother was the wife of a polygamist, was always very interested in those northern colonies. But they were more mainstream Mormon from the current Mormon church. Whereas down the road at Colonia LeBaron, those were a fundamentalist offshoot that was continuing to practice polygamy.
I want to get back to your family a little bit because that's so interesting, the personal experience. But when you first started writing this book or deciding to write this book, it ends up covering a lot of different things. Was your first inspiration to learn more about these families, or was it to figure out what happened on the road that day during the massacre?
It was absolutely to figure out what happened. I have a long career, as you pointed out. I've written 8 books and 2 about Mormonism, and I've written extensively about narcotics trafficking in Mexico and into the United States. I've written about organized crime. So when I learned of this, actually on CNN, when I learned of this incident, it just struck me immediately as there was more to this story. This was not a case of mistaken identity. It wasn't a case of people being at the wrong place at the wrong time. This was a group of women and children intentionally targeted in the most brutal and heinous way. And I was initially really moved by the tragedy and thought it would be really important to figure out what was going on. And my main impetus, John, was really, why were these women and children traveling alone on one of the most dangerous roads in the world? Where were the men? Why were they unarmed? Why were they unescorted?
And obviously, they were well aware of the dangers on that road. You write that LeBaron is almost certainly the largest Mormon community in Mexico today. It's both the name of this family and the community. How big a community are we talking about, and what percentage of those people are interrelated?
The Colonia LeBaron, which is located in Chihuahua, is relatively tiny. I think that the Mormon Church, Mexico, I believe, has the second largest population of LDS members, faithful, in Mexico. But the Colonia LeBaron is a tiny community of between 3,500 and 5,000. And it is the largest polygamous community in Mexico. Obviously, this is not a mainstream colony, and the name is inseparable from the colony. They are interrelated going back several generations. And the LeBaron patriarchs, the men, the leaders, which vie with each other or against each other for the leadership of the colony, but the patriarchs themselves from the original LeBaron family claim that their bloodline goes back to Jesus and Mary and Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, and that they are carrying the mantle of the true church. The true believing polygamists believe that when the church abandoned polygamy in the 1890s and in exchange for statehood with the United States, that was an accommodation that the true believers who then left for Mexico and parts of the Southwest, which were then still Mexican territory, that the true believers were really the one true church, and that Brigham Young was a usurper to the throne of Joseph Smith.
In terms of contemporary history, going back to the years before the massacre, what is this balance like between these Mormon sects and the drug cartels down there? How do they coexist?
Well, they've coexisted for a very long time. The LeBaron colony and the Mormon colonies up north, closer to the Texas border, they've coexisted with the drug traffickers for long before there was a cartel. And I posit in my book, I quote several members of the families, that it was a gentleman's agreement that they gave each other wide berth. This was not an attack on the LeBaron family because of their practice of polygamy or because of their religion, but there was friction between the cartels and the LeBaron family that began, I posit, with the incarceration of Joaquin Guzman, El Chapo, just a couple of months before this massacre happened. And whatever tensions might have been seething below the surface came to a head when Chapo was tried in New York and sentenced to life in prison in the Supermax prison in Colorado. And it threw the entire region into chaos because Chapo had been controlling that region for at least 30 years. And there were various factions, then rivals, trying to ascend to take control of his empire.
Where does that overlap with the Mormon communities? Because you mentioned tensions and factions. How do these communities relate to each other? Are there deals they have between each other that are practical? When you say a wide berth, are there tendrils between them that tie them together in some way?
Absolutely. And this is a remote region. One of the thrusts of my book ends up being, and I didn't know any of this going in, this is all as a result of research, but one of the main thrusts of the book is that there are a lot of different interests. The LeBaron community is extremely wealthy and have these large nut farms in the hands of a handful of family members, the patriarchs, that are worth millions and millions of dollars, pecan and walnut farms, and which require an extraordinary amount of water compared to the crops of the other local indigenous and Mexican farmers in the region who date back as farmers for generations. And suddenly they're having trouble getting access to the water and their communities are dwindling. The LeBaron properties are surrounded by extreme poverty. And that was getting more and more obvious and ostentatious in the weeks and months and previous, I would say, 2 years leading up to the massacre.
You talk about positing things in the book. I doubt that we can know for sure what happened because I imagine that it's very hard to get information about this, which brings me to the broader question of just getting information in general for this book, you know, who you talked to, how reluctant some people might have been, whether you got stonewalled or pushed back from the community.
I was very fortunate in getting access early on, especially to the women, other women that are in the community, a lot of women who have escaped the community. If you want to see what life is like living as a woman without where the man controls everything, this is a male-dominated religion based on female servitude, both spiritually and economically and domestically and in every single way. So in some ways, this is a cautionary tale to see with rollbacks happening in the United States on a woman's right. This is a microcosm of what that looks like. And I was surprised initially that there were so many people that were willing to talk to me, not just women who had left, not just women who were scared for their lives and living there, you know, in this war zone, but a lot of the men who also have left the community, because in a polygamous community where the leader is usually an older man and the property is owned by LeBaron men, in a polygamous relationship, only the first wife is considered legal. And that's true in both the United States. Well, polygamy is illegal in both the United States and Mexico, but the polygamous men, generally, there's one woman who is the wife, who is a legal wife, and the other wives, they don't have social security cards or birth certificates. They don't have much free agency to leave if they wanted to, or a source of income. So I was really stunned at how many people were willing to talk to me. And I got very deep inside law enforcement, Mexican and, well, on both sides of the border, law enforcement investigating the massacre itself and the events leading up to it. I had a high-level DEA source who was on the ground, and I had former one of the primary source for me in initially untangling. It was Michael S.B. Hill, who was one of the most decorated drug enforcement agents in the United States, who worked undercover in Mexico for 30 years. It was not as opaque as I was concerned about it being at the time. Plus, my ability to travel was limited from the pandemic. So anyway, it was stunning to me how courageous a lot of the women were who were willing to talk.
Did some of them give you a sense of why, the ones who weren't disgruntled or had left the community? Many of them wanted to remain anonymous for reasons that are understandable.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the things I explored, and that's why I decided to weave the history into it. The more I looked at the events and the characters, the more intrigued I became and wanted to look deeper, not just into the murders, but the relationships, which led me to this often sordid history of polygamy in that region of northern Mexico and also in the western United States. My goal was to illuminate the context of not just the murders, but the actors who were involved and were complicit. And I did that by bringing in my own family history and polygamy, which I think enriched the story with the historic context of Mormonism and polygamy. And at the heart of much of that is, why do the women stay? Why are women attracted to this religion to begin with? Why do they stay even after sometimes they have the opportunity to leave? And at the root of that is that in this sect, the only possibility for a woman to enter heaven, eternity, is with a worthy man. And that's the crux of the faith in itself. It's a woman's desire, if she's a true believer in the religion, her only value is as chattel, basically, to the man. The husband, the property of the husband, are the wives and the children.
You talked about your own family's history. It sounds like your parents were maybe the first generation to not have any experience with that. How was that history passed down to you? What were your parents' thoughts about it? And how much does that fuel your interest in the subject?
My mother was from Kentucky, but my father, there was a long history of polygamy in Utah Territory in the 1800s, that this was before Utah statehood. And people who wanted to escape polygamy or Mormonism in Utah went across the border of what would become Nevada. And I'm fourth generation Nevadan and was raised in Nevada. But my father had a long history. His mother was raised in polygamy, and she was the youngest daughter, I think the 23rd child of the second wife. And so he grew up firsthand recognizing the trials that his grandmother faced in Utah when polygamy was abandoned in 1890. The law meant that the second wife was suddenly a concubine and all of her children were bastards. So suddenly my father's mother was a little girl in the mountains of Utah being raised by a woman with a whole pack of children that were abandoned by the church. So there were a lot of bitter memories from that end. My father was raised Mormon until he abandoned it as a young man, but he saw firsthand the pain that it caused his mother as a child of polygamy and the pain that it caused his grandmother for being abandoned by the first husband and the church ultimately.
I have to finish by asking you a broader question, because I'm always fascinated by people who do the kind of investigative work you do. I consider it very brave and very different from my own temperament or capabilities. Do you remember back to when you first felt the capability of doing that, the excitement of doing it, the thought that maybe you would do it? Did you have to overcome any fear or timidity, or did it just feel like a part of your nature from a young age?
I tend to say to my children, who my grown sons who went through a lot of these, all these books with me, that I was too stupid to know the danger that I was in. And I was always digging up things to the extent that by the time I was a threat to anybody, it was too late. Nobody believed me. I was young and blonde and blue-eyed and with stunned to learn these things that I was being told. And I'm sure most of these, you know, men in power didn't think I was smart enough to remember what they were saying anyway. But I got my start with a little newspaper in northern New Mexico outside of Santa Fe. And I went to Jack Anderson in Washington after that and really honed my skills. Jack was syndicated in 1,000 newspapers and was an investigative reporter, LDS from Salt Lake City. But that's where I really learned a lot of the skills that I then transferred to my writing.
Well, you put them to good use in many fascinating books, the latest of which is The Colony, Faith and Blood in a Promised Land. Thanks again, Sally, for being here to talk about it.
Thanks so much.
My colleague Alexandra Alter joins me now with news from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, John.
So the news is from the literary world on the selling side.
That's right. And it's good news, which is nice. We all could use some good news.
I could use a lot. So exactly. Let's get started.
During the early phase of the pandemic, I was on the podcast a lot, kind of ringing alarm bells about bookstores. The publishing industry was really concerned that they could see all these gains that independent bookstores had made in the years prior to the pandemic kind of being wiped out because the stores were shut down. Even as stores scrambled to sell online, they weren't, you know, making enough money. The sales that they used to gain through things like authors events were just decimated. So there was a period where the American Booksellers Association projected that hundreds of stores could close permanently. And instead, we've seen not only that bookstores survived the pandemic, but they have been thriving, many of them. And hundreds of new bookstores have opened in the last couple of years, more than 300 around the country. So that's a huge shift. It's not only maintaining the gains that were made prior to the health emergency, but things have accelerated. And so I think there's a number of kind of interesting things happening, both in the publishing industry and the retail space, but also more broadly in the economy that probably contributed to this. One is people, what they call the great resignation, people taking stock of their lives. A number of the new booksellers that my colleague Liz Harris and I spoke to for the story had earlier careers that they suddenly found to be unfulfilling during the pandemic, and they had some money saved and they felt like it was the moment to make a giant change. And there are also more retail spaces available at lower rents, sometimes because of the pandemic and people just reevaluating where they are in life. The other sort of surprising thing and an encouraging thing that the American Booksellers Association noted in their recent report on their membership base is that there's a lot more diversity now among booksellers. It was traditionally a very white occupation, and there's a lot more bookstores that have recently opened in the last year or two that are run by people of color. And sometimes the people that we spoke to for the piece said they felt compelled to open their store because they wanted to highlight either books by immigrants, books by people of color, books that they felt weren't always centered in the bookstores that they had been shopping in. So that's an interesting new thing in the retail industry too.
It's all good news. I remember those early days and the pieces that you would write, which at the time, of course, were very real. And I was, like many people, ordering books from, you know, a store that I could easily walk to have them shipped home just to keep the store hopefully doing well. So is the sense that those stores that were predicted to close early in the pandemic, they didn't really close? They weathered the storm and then these additional stores came along? It's not that a bunch of stores closed early in the pandemic and so now there's a rise in the number.
That's correct. There were a number of stores that closed during the pandemic, quite a few, but more have opened. So it's not sort of a revival of stores that closed coming back into existence. A lot of these are brand new stores around the country. And the other thing, as you mentioned, walking to your store to buy books just to keep them open. I think the amount of goodwill that shoppers and community residents displayed towards bookstores has carried over beyond the emergency days of when all these stores had to close. People, I think it might have changed people's habits in terms of, you know, if you were shopping online before, people might buy from Amazon and then they realized, oh, my independent bookstore around the corner actually, you know, if I want to ship something to someone across country, they now have online ordering and they didn't have that before. There's also bookshop.org was a new thing that started during the pandemic. And that was a huge lifeline for a lot of independent stores who were able to fulfill orders through Bookshop if they didn't have websites operating of their own. So I think we saw a lot of creativity and flexibility, and those skills have put independent stores for the most part in a stronger position. I mean, there is obviously always a dark cloud that I have to, I'm sorry to bring this down, but there's downward economic trends right now that I think are very concerning. There is a lot of tangled supply chain issues that booksellers have been caught up in that's affected publishing as much as the broader economy. Rents are rising, interest rates are rising, labor shortages, the need to increase wages to keep up with inflation. So when you have...
Alexandra.
Yes.
You said this was going to be good news.
I'll get back to the good news, I promise.
Okay.
What I mean is it's still a good time to shop at your independent store, as always. No, but there, you know, there is always, particularly for smaller businesses, when there is economic pressure, that is amplified because you don't have the cushion that larger companies have. So, you know, the other concern, I think, that's not just limited to bookstores, but is broadly being felt right now in the publishing industry, is will there be a recession that reduces people's discretionary spending and all this money that people spent on books during the pandemic, and they spent quite a bit more than they had previously. Is that behavior going to change? So I think people are watching nervously, but let's go back to the good news. This is a really positive development, particularly after the rise of Amazon. Before that, the rise of big box stores, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Walmart, all those trends took a bite out of what used to be a very healthy, robust base of independent stores. And to see independent stores coming back and thriving is a really positive thing.
Yes. And just to cross our fingers for the future, it does sound like the adaptations that people were forced to make in dire times have maybe led to a healthier long-term track and business plan for some of these places. And this is very much an independent trend we're talking about. These are smaller stores, you know, locally owned stores. And like you said, somewhat specialized stores, which is interesting because it gets more and different kinds of books out into people's hands.
Exactly. And because of those specializations too, and combine that with the ability to sell books online, some of these little local stores find that they have customers all over the country. For example, I spoke to Nichelle Lawrence, who's a new bookseller in Lansing, Michigan, and she had the idea to open a store that would really specialize in titles by and about Black women. And she got some early press coverage, and now she has a website, and she has people ordering from her shop who are from all over the country and all over the world. Those two things together, I think, put independent booksellers in a much more stable position than they were even before the pandemic.
Well, a friend and I many years ago used to fantasize about opening a bookstore / cheese shop. So
oh,
I feel like going to write up a business plan now. You've inspired me.
Please add me as your cheese guru / monger.
You're our board of cheese advisors.
Yes, exactly.
We'll take it. But Alexandra, I appreciate the good news. The piece is online in full if people would like to learn more specifics about some of these individual stores that have opened. Thanks for coming by to talk about it.
Thanks, John.
Two of the Times' critics, Alexandra Jacobs and Jennifer Salai, join me now to talk about books they've recently reviewed. Hello, you two.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Jen, why don't we start with you?
So I reviewed a book called Why We Did It, and it's by Tim Miller, who's a former Republican operative. And I should say what the subtitle is, because I think it's really quite evocative of what the book is actually about. It's called A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. And so Miller is trying to describe how the Republican Party went from essentially abhorring Trump to embracing him in 2016 as the standard bearer. And Miller himself isn't one of those people who ever allied himself with Trump. So this isn't like a lot of those Republicans who now have to essentially justify why they initially supported Trump and eventually changed their minds. He's somebody who's actually trying to describe the people he knew who went from really disliking Trump to eventually embracing him. And so he looks at the people who worked with him on what's called the 2012 Republican autopsy. That's generally the colloquial term for a report that the party put together in order to explain why Mitt Romney lost against Obama in that year.
And who is Miller? Why was he part of this group?
So Miller has worked on several Republican campaigns. He's quite young. I think he's a millennial. He's somebody who's worked within the party for a long time. He's well connected. And so he was, I think, brought on to this report because he was somebody who, first of all, was young. So he could maybe speak to where the party should go. So he, along with a bunch of these other people, looked at what was happening with the Republican Party and whether or not they were alienating voters. And this was a report that essentially said that the party should work on outreach, that it should, you know, look at things like immigration reform, that it essentially should tack toward the center. And so I think what Miller wants to examine is why a lot of the people who worked with him on that report ended up being very adamant Trumpists in the end. You know, Elise Stefanik is one of the examples he provides.
Who is she for people who aren't in this area?
She's a representative from New York, and she's somebody who's quite known now as a very vocal Trump supporter. But that wasn't always the case. You know, as he points out, these were people who initially were really not just suspicious of Trump, but really didn't like him at first. And so he wants to look at that transformation. And he himself is gay. And that was something that he kept hidden for a while at the beginning when he was working in Republican politics. And he says that as somebody who tried to keep that hidden, he really had to compartmentalize his life. And so what he says very explicitly in this book is that his skills at compartmentalization is one of the things that really enables him, he says, to understand the Trumpist's mindset.
Is he saying that it's compartmentalization or just a sort of crude power grab? And also, what is the style in which he writes this book? Because we're making him sound like a bit of a policy wonk or something, but he's kind of a renegade, right?
Totally, totally. He says that there's a variety of reasons why people turned into essentially what he calls Trump enablers. And compartmentalization is one of the things that helps them actually do what they need to do, but there's a lot of motivations beyond that. And one of the big ones he notes is that these are people who really care about their careers and ambitions within the structure of the party. And so as the party essentially became the party of Trump, once Trump was president, they realized that their fortunes were better served by supporting Trump rather than challenging him. And then in terms of the style of the book, he is definitely not one of these earnest, sincere writers who's trying to make himself look like the most upstanding citizen you could ever meet. He's very candid. He's pretty profane. There's a lot of cussing in the book. He writes in this darkly satirical vein. There are several moments where looking at his own history with the party. I mean, he himself came out, as I mentioned, as a never Trumper early on, but he continued to do stuff that essentially helped the Trump administration once Trump got into power. I mean, he worked for Scott Pruitt, who became the director of the EPA. So there are things that he has to essentially explain. And he's candid about that to a certain extent. But yeah, the style of the book is very much darkly, I would say comic, but it's not really funny what he's describing.
I mean, partly he admits that he just did it for the rush, right?
Oh, yeah. No, he admits to his own enormous ambitions, and he likes the rush. He likes winning. Winning is a huge part of it. And essentially what he says is that he and a lot of the people around him just got fixated on the winning part, and that all the other questions about values, about principles, about governance, about policy, that just essentially got pushed to the wayside.
Alexandra, speaking of guilt and other subjects, what did you review this week?
This week, I reviewed Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence by Ken Oletta. And it is, as I wrote, it is a cradle-to-jail biography of the disgraced movie mogul whose troubles have been very much covered. First, in the work of our own Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, they wrote a book about their breaking the story of Weinstein's crimes. Ronan Farrow also did a book after his reporting in The New Yorker.
So given the work of our journalists and Farrow, both in journalism and in books, I assume that Oletta, you called it a biography. Is the angle here less about the crimes and more just telling the life?
It's a really interesting book. It takes the long arc, the wide, or you could say like the wide panoramic lens of the Weinstein life. How was this possible? I think to younger generations of women, it might seem incredible that Harvey Weinstein got away with what he got away with for so long. And this book really attempts to explicate, how did this happen? How did this guy do this in plain sight?
But is there also the angle of how did it happen from inside of him? Like, how did he become this person? Does it psychologize him at all?
He does psychologize him, and I think it does that a little less effectively. It's very hard. The closest Aletta comes, he frames it as in the model of Citizen Kane. And, you know, famously, Citizen Kane begins with the dying muggle saying Rosebud. And then there's this reporter in the movie who's trying to figure out what Rosebud means. Rosebud is now a metaphor for cracking the code to someone's personality. But Ken Aletta, I feel the closest he comes to Rosebud is writing about the Weinstein brothers' mother, Miriam, for whom Miramax was half named. Miramax, their movie studio, was named for Miriam and Max, their parents. And it's tough. You know, on the one hand, Ken Aletta's writing a book about women and their stories and their voices and oppression. And then, you know, it seems maybe a little bit chin scratching about then blaming the mother. But, you know, he doesn't quite do that. But by all accounts, the Weinstein brothers were berated. Miriam was a very forceful figure who berated the sons. And in particular, it seems Harvey, you know, she called him fat. She'd say, are you really going to eat that? She was a powerhouse, for better or worse.
Harvey and his brother Bob were both under her sway. And Aletta talked to Bob a lot. So does he get it why maybe they're so different?
Often in families of four and nuclear families like that, there's a sort of polarization where one sibling will ally with one parent. And it does seem like Bob hewed more closely to Max, whom he describes as a moral person, and Harvey was a little more under Miriam's sway.
Well, what's the balance in the book between the culture of silence and the subtitle and the biographical material? The subtitle makes it sound like a culture book, but actually the review and looking through the book, it does seem more like about the Weinsteins and his life growing up and then as a promoter and then obviously a movie mogul.
It traces his life. The thing is, Harvey and Bob were tremendously ambitious and really committed to this career trajectory for most of their adulthood. The Weinstein brothers, people don't remember necessarily. There was really, in the 90s, there was this kind of blooming of independent cinema and this idea that good movies could do really well. In the book, Aletta writes of how he passed on Marvel, which would have ensured the fortunes of the company, but they really had a commitment to the sort of art house film, which, you know, in the age of streaming, it's just so different.
I feel like the book is an odd mix listening to you. I mean, it's not an apologia, obviously. It's not a reburnishing of what he did as a movie producer.
But he has to, in order to write a book of this, a biography of this convicted criminal, he wants to make the case that Harvey Weinstein is not just a monster. He's doing a shaded portrait. Aletta profiled Weinstein 20 years ago in The New Yorker and draws upon that. So I think there's probably some element of him that feels not complicit. Most of us who were journalists in the 90s brushed with Harvey Weinstein at some point. We all knew. I think there's self-examination going on there as well. The whole system of movies and entertainment journalism is sort of scrutinized.
Is it safe to assume that Harvey didn't talk to him for this book?
He doesn't talk to him, but there's some terse emailing. He did know of Harvey's misdeeds, but he couldn't get victims on the record. That took the more recent reporting. So he knew him, and he's tremendously well-connected, and he does communicate with Harvey and his representatives. Harvey wants to vet this book, and with typical Harveyness, thinks he can maybe control it or spin it a bit. So you watch the process of that happening, which is fascinating. Eventually, there's a fade out.
But he did not vet the book, obviously.
He did not. Oh, of course not. No, he did not vet the book. But there's interesting procedural back and forth between Aletta and Weinstein's team. Really, it gives you a snapshot into the way Weinstein manipulated the press for years for access.
Well, you do mention that plenty of the details in the book are disgusting and that you have to have a semi-strong stomach to read it. And that reading it is like, as you write, getting on one of those creaky roller coasters at a faded municipal playland. So a sad book about a grim subject. Let's go over the books you reviewed again. Jen?
I reviewed Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell by Tim Miller.
And I reviewed Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence by Ken Aletta.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm John Williams.